This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News, and I'm Joe Palca. Later in the hour, we'll talk science words with the editor of a new science dictionary. But first, the 20th century saw three influenza pandemics, including the 1918 Spanish flu, that claimed the lives of nearly 20 million people worldwide. Overcrowding and urbanization combined with greater international travel make it likely that another pandemic will occur. The latest threat is avian influenza, a kind of flu that can jump from birds to humans and has infected dozens of people throughout Asia in recent years. And avian flu is lethal. The numbers are changing daily, but of the 44 reported cases last year, more than 30 people have died. Scientists believe that the main factor preventing the avian flu from creating a pandemic is its inability to pass easily from person to person. But person-to-person transmission has occurred. This week's New England Journal of Medicine presents evidence an 11-year-old girl passed the disease to her mother and aunt in Thailand. If such cases become more frequent, experts warn we could be in for major trouble. Avian flu is our topic, so give us a call with your questions. Our number is 1-800-989-8255. That's 1-800-989-TALK. If you want more information about what we'll be talking about this hour, go to our website at www.sciencefriday.com, where you'll find links to our topic. Now, let me introduce my guests. Klaus Stöhr is the project leader for the World Health Organization's Global Influenza Program. He joins us by phone from Geneva, Switzerland. Welcome back to Science Friday, Dr. Stöhr.
Hello.
Hello. And also with us is John Trainer. He's an associate professor of medicine and of microbiology and immunology at the University of Rochester School of Medicine and Dentistry. He joins us from the studios of WXXI in Rochester, New York. Welcome back to Talk of the Nation, Dr. Trainer.
Thanks very much.
And Arnold Monto is a professor of epidemiology at the School of Public Health of the University of Michigan. He joins us by phone from the campus in Arbor. Welcome back to you also, Dr. Monto. Thanks for talking with us today.
Nice talking to you.
So, Dr. Stöhr, I'd like to start with you. This report in New England Journal about the avian flu being passed from an 11-year-old girl who was cared for by her mother and aunt, and these two women subsequently came down with the flu. The girl and her mother both died. The aunt was very sick but survived. First of all, are you convinced that this is a true case of person-to-person transmission, or is there some other way these other women could have gotten the flu?
Well, investigating those cases is a little bit like investigating a criminal case. It's always, in most circumstances, circumstantial evidence. So there will be no final proof. But all the evidence which exists would clearly indicate that there has been some human-to-human transmission in that cluster. One has to emphasize that this is something which one would expect from this virus to do. Human-to-human transmission, we call it inefficient, non-sustained, dead end street. Human-to-human transmission is a feature of this virus. It has happened before, and it's happening now in Vietnam. We have the second little family cluster where somebody who cared for a critically ill patient in all likelihood got the disease in a hospital. So that this is not beyond expectation from what this avian influenza virus can do.
So maybe we should just get you to explain. I mean, the flu virus that is the normal human flu virus is passed very easily. Is that the distinction you're making?
Absolutely. The H5N1 virus, which is in poultry in Asia, is used to spread very rapidly, very easily between poultry. It takes much more virus to infect the human than to infect the chicken. And the transmission from human to human is it's the absolute exception. It's in no way a rule. So it does happen very rare, very seldom, and these infectious chains are short, one or two links, and they're always dead end streets.
So if this is a difficult virus to transmit, why are people worried about the possibility that it could lead to a pandemic?
Now, this virus has caused more than 50 deaths already. Now, this is therefore of concern. However, there's a second feature this virus had, namely that it can, either by gradual mutation adapt better to the human host, or it can perhaps exchange its genetic information whilst it is infecting one person with another influenza virus, namely a human influenza virus. The marriage of these two viruses would lead to progeny virus, which would presumably much more likely transmissible in humans, but would still cause very severe disease, and that could then lead to a pandemic.
I see. That's the nightmare scenario, that somehow someone who gets one infection gets the other infection, and these they exchange their best or worst features, and then that person infects somebody else with the new, more dangerous and easily transmitted virus. Got it. So how will you know, Dr. Stur, if you've got that kind of a problem on your hands?
Well, there are people who are saying it's going to stick out like a sore thumb. What we are seeing today is perhaps a second person after 4 or 5 days falling ill, and there will be no further transmission within the family. There will be no further transmission in the household, in the neighboring village, in the district. And that's why in investigation in those cases is so important to rule out that this virus has gained more human-to-human transmissibility. If it had, we will see more clusters. We will see at the same time more cases in the same family in the same district, and perhaps jumping then into the next district and perhaps very quickly into another country.
Dr. Manto, can I turn to you and ask, I mean, are you convinced at this point that it will stick out like a sore thumb if this virus starts getting much more lethal, or could it take place in some small community in some remote area of Thailand or Vietnam, and we wouldn't know about it until many months had passed?
Well, I don't think it will take us several months to notice it, even if it occurs in a remote area. I think we are concerned that it could happen in a remote area, and then we wouldn't be able to do what we hope to be able to do to try to contain it at its source while it is gradually changing to become more transmissible from person to person. The hope is that this will be a gradual event, that it won't all of a sudden mutate in a way that it becomes both transmissible and retains being very lethal. So what we can do is to improve our surveillance, so if it does occur in the right place, we can detect it, and then to try to develop mechanisms for trying to delay further spread or to stop further spread.
Okay, Dr. Manto, I want to turn quickly back to Dr. Stur because I gather that he has to leave. But just before you take off, and I appreciate your staying up and talking to us. I know it's late now in Geneva, but is there something that we should be waiting for right away? Is the WHO feel it's got what it needs to address this problem, or are there things that have to happen in the next few weeks or days?
Well, what has happened in the last year is that the affected countries have geared up. The surveillance systems are becoming better. That we see more cases in Vietnam now is not only an increase in transmission to human, it also demonstrates that surveillance functions much better than last year. And the same certainly applies to Vietnam. We are much less certain about what's going on in other countries, Laos, Cambodia, where surveillance may not be so good, and the health as well as the agriculture infrastructure is much different. In the long term, we have to realize that H5N1 will stay in Asia. There is no indication that the virus will disappear on its own. It has now it has been entrenched in domestic ducks, which do not fall ill, like poultry, which are much more difficult to detect then. There are countries who have tailored their control programs now to years rather than months, so they expect in Thailand to control the disease in 2007 or 8. The same for Vietnam and Indonesia. So we will live with this disease, and a profound change in pandemic risk, a profound progress in controlling the disease in humans will not happen unless there are profound changes in agricultural practices and in eliminating this virus from its animal reservoir. That's going to be the breakthrough which we are looking for, and this will require the concerted efforts, not only by the affected countries, but all those who would then be certainly affected by a pandemic virus, which would spread globally and would not spare a single country.
All right. Thank you, Dr. Sturr, for staying with us for that long. I know you've got to leave. Thanks very much.
I thank you.
Klaus Sturr is the project leader for the World Health Organization's Global Influenza Program. He joined us by phone from Geneva, Switzerland. And so now coming back to my guests who are still on the line, Dr. Trainer from Rochester University, and he's in a studio in Rochester, New York. Maybe I can turn to you now and simply say, where are we with a vaccine? I know we had this, you know, this huge problem this year with shortages of the human influenza vaccine, but where are we with a vaccine that might protect humans from avian influenza?
Well, I think the general idea is that we should try, at least at first, to use the same kind of vaccine strategies to make something to protect against H5 that we use to protect against regular flu.
Now, when you say H5, that's the scientific shorthand for avian flu.
Right. Okay. That is the name of the particular strain of avian flu that's of most concern for starting the next pandemic. It's not the only one that people are worried about, but it's the one that it's at the top of the list. And to make a vaccine against that virus, we'll probably start out using the same approach that we use for regular flu, which would be a standard killed or inactivated vaccine grown in eggs and purified and given as a shot.
I got it. And is there one that's gotten into a stage where it's ready to be tested?
Yes, there are actually two preparations of pilot H5 vaccines that have been made by companies that make regular vaccines and that are just about to start clinical testing with the goal of determining that they actually provide some level of antibody response and that they're well tolerated.
All right. We'll be talking this hour about influenza, the avian form, and its scientific name, H5N1. And the other H's and the other N's, which can be trouble to us. But right now, we've got to take a short break. So please stay with us for as we take your calls about avian influenza. Remember, our number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Please stay with us. We're talking this hour about the avian flu with my guest, John Trainer. He's an associate professor of medicine and microbiology and immunology at the University of Rochester School of Medicine and Dentistry. And Arnold Monto is a professor of epidemiology at the School of Public Health at the University of Michigan. And let's take some calls now. Why don't we go first to Paul in Honolulu, Hawaii. Uh-oh, I think I pressed the wrong button. Let's try Chris in Kalamazoo, Michigan.
Hi.
Is this Chris?
Yes, it is.
Okay, so I've got the buttons and the mixed up, but I guess I've got you now. Go ahead.
My question is, how does the avian flu compare to SARS and its effect on people and its lethality, mortality?
Dr. Monto, can you speak to that question at all?
Well, SARS is very different in the way it transmitted to avian flu. Avian flu, as we see it in people, does cause respiratory infection, but it transmits very differently. We were able to actually control SARS and more or less eliminate it because it is shed rather late. What that means is that the person doesn't begin to excrete the virus in sufficient quantity to spread until well into the disease. Now, what that meant was that there wasn't a whole lot of community spread, but there was a lot of spread in the hospital after the person was admitted until we realized how transmission was occurring and then you needed to have very rigorous isolation techniques. And we were able to control SARS by isolation and quarantine, by quarantining contacts, those people who were in contact with cases, and isolating the cases. And we really don't have any human SARS coronavirus transmission that we know of in the world. The difference is not so much in the disease severity, which is hard to quantify, but rather in the way it will transmit. And we're concerned that if avian flu starts to become efficiently transmitted from human to human, there won't be stopping it, because with flu, there's transmission before the case becomes symptomatic, and that's a big difference.
Chris, thanks very much for that call. Let's go next to, this time I think I can get it right, Paul in Honolulu, Hawaii. Paul, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. My question is, I think we understand the changes that can take place to allow for human transmission. However, what I'd like to know is, what are the characteristics of this avian flu that makes it so much more lethal than the run-of-the-mill flu that we get every year? How does it affect the human body in a different way than the flu that we are used to experiencing? Thank you very much.
Okay, thanks. Dr. Trainer, is it safe to ask that question of you as a physician? Or
it's safe to ask the question. I don't know if I'll know the answer. Paul's question actually is a very fundamental one that is, as it turns out, quite complicated. There are probably a number of features of the H5N1 avian virus that make it very pathogenic in humans. One is, of course, that people who get infected with this virus have no immunity to it when the infection begins. So unlike regular flu, which you've experienced in the past, this flu virus, it doesn't resemble other viruses you've been exposed to. And so you have no immunity starting out in the infection. And then that certainly plays a role in the severity. But then there are other features of the virus itself that may have special properties that enhance how severe the illness is. And people are focused on some of the molecular mechanisms that flu viruses use to combat the host's innate immune system, that part of the immune system that doesn't require being educated by previous infections, particularly the way that we make a particular substance called interferon in response to viruses, seems to be subverted or getting away from by those avian viruses. They appear to have mechanisms to get around that interferon response that may make them more lethal.
Yeah. Dr. Monto, it seems to me I also read, if it was in your article, I can't recall now, in New England Journal, that there are some features of avian flu that it's more likely to cause pneumonia than maybe other kinds of flu. Is that right?
Well, yes. And as Dr. Trainer said, we are not exactly sure why all this is happening, because we really haven't seen that many cases of avian influenza, this kind of avian influenza, transmitted to humans. But the cases that have been reported from Asia do show pneumonia as a rather consistent feature, a viral pneumonia. And basically, we don't see, except in unusual circumstances, viral pneumonia as part of ordinary influenza. We do see it, but most of the deaths that occur from pneumonia in people who get influenza come from bacterial complications. So this is distinctly different. And what we would hope, the good news would be that if this virus does become more able to transmit from human to human through combining with a human virus, it may become less pathogenic, less able to cause severe disease. But what concerns us is we don't know that.
Yeah. Well, I guess it's not an experiment that anybody wants to see happen in the real world. But let's try another call. Nanette from Royal Oak, Michigan, welcome to the program.
Thank you. My question is about the people that have succumbed to the avian flu. Has anybody checked the state of their respiratory health prior to their succumbing?
Interesting question. Dr. Monto, do you know if people who've gotten the avian flu have had pre-existing physical problems?
Well, the avian flu, the H5 avian flu that we are seeing in Vietnam and Thailand principally, what's unusual about this outbreak, which started last year, is that it's mainly occurring in children. Most of the cases are children. Very few of them are in older individuals. Now, we didn't see that in Hong Kong in the 1997 outbreak, and that may be because they were mainly poultry workers. It came from the live bird market. And what we're seeing in Vietnam now is children who basically work or live with chickens. They're backyard flocks, and they are exposed to chickens, and chickens are part of the family. Now, the presumption is that these are normal children that really have not had pre-existing respiratory conditions, So this would be very different from the way we recommend influenza vaccine currently for high-risk individuals, those with chronic respiratory disease. So totally different, a new kind of situation.
Nanette, thanks very much for that. Dr. Monto, can I ask you to describe this this proposal that's been floated of possibly using a drug that's currently approved for treating flu, known flu, as somehow be used as a prophylaxis? I wonder if you can explain the thinking there.
Well, this is thinking that I've articulated or talked about in the article I had in the New England Journal this week, but actually is being discussed at various levels. And the idea is that if we see, as we are seeing, cases of bird flu occurring in humans at a low level in a place like Vietnam, and if we see human-to-human transmission, that then the transmission to humans and the adaptation to humans may occur gradually. And if this is the case, we do have an antiviral called oseltamivir, or Tamiflu, which is licensed for prophylaxis or prevention and treatment of regular flu. It might be possible to use this drug to try to control early transmission. Now, this would take not only having the drug in the right place, but being able to see this happen and also to have limited transmission initially. And this is something which we think, some of us think, we really ought to prepare to implement if, in fact, we do begin to see this limited transmission.
Dr. Trainer, can you explain the difference between using a drug as a prophylactic and using a vaccine? How those, because I think people are a little confused, or perhaps it's just me, but how you use a drug as a preventative?
Well, actually, you know, I've often thought that we make too much of that distinction between using a vaccine and using a drug. For the end user, the person who's being protected, the only difference is that typically you only have to give a vaccine once or twice at the beginning of the period when you might be exposed, and you're then protected. Whereas with a drug, you'd have to administer that every day or every other day, depending on the drug, for the whole period of time that you might be exposed. So from that point of view, they're actually very similar. They're both interventions that you start before you're exposed to whatever it is you're worried about, and that then protect you when you do become exposed, as opposed, for example, to using something to treat a person after they're already infected and ill with a pathogen. Mm-hmm. Now, in the case of the flu vaccine, you would be trying to work on the immune system with a vaccine by stimulating the body to make antibody that would recognize that flu virus and kill it before it had a chance to infect you. Whereas with the drug, you would be inhibiting some critical function of the virus that would prevent it from growing. So the end result would be the same, but they'd accomplish it in slightly different ways.
Okay. Let's take another call now. Jeff in Palo Alto, California. Jeff, welcome to the program.
Thank you for taking my call. I understand that most flus kill the elderly or the young. However, the Spanish flu killed a disproportionate number of people in their prime, 20 to 30-year-olds. And it was thought that an aggressive immune response ended up sabotaging and killing, so your body killed yourself.
Hmm.
I'm wondering if that's actually true. And second, if you could have a strategy, if you can't get a virus, an immunization, to somehow decrease the immune response such that you can live through it. You may be sick as ever, but you live through it.
Interesting point. What, Dr. Monto, is that something you can address at all?
Yeah, but we don't know exactly why the healthy young adults died during the 1918 Spanish flu pandemic. We are making an enormous amount of progress in understanding this virus because it's been possible from specimens from basically soldiers who died of 1918 influenza. They've been able to recover the RNA of the virus and to actually reconstruct the virus. Now, we can't put it in people, but it's being put. A construct of this virus is being put in laboratory animals to try to understand better why this virus was so lethal, because as your caller pointed out, that's very important in terms of trying to anticipate what to do in terms of any kind of new pandemic virus. Now, we are not sure why the new avian flu virus is affecting mainly children. The scenario I described was based on what we think we know in terms of the exposures, but it has transmitted not only in the situation that was reported this week in the New England Journal, which actually happened in September, but there are suspicions that the same thing is going on in Vietnam right now. Dr. Storr was referring to clusters of cases, and that's what we're concerned about, because we really have no idea of the way it's going to behave in terms of its lethality in people.
I see. We're talking about avian influenza and the possibility of it causing global problems. Our number is 1-800-989-8255. I'm Joe Palca, and this is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Let's try another call, this time from Larry, I think. I got to count down here. 1, 2, 3, 4. Larry in Sioux Falls, South Dakota. Larry, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Enjoy your program very much.
And thanks.
A very, very timely subject. I would comment that in December I was at a national agricultural conference in Minneapolis, Minnesota, and a professor from the University of Minnesota was on the agenda and described the avian flu to us. And he happened to be on the Homeland Security Council. And he said, although we assume that terrorism may be a threat to the United States and to the world, he said, in his opinion, this is the number one threat to life in the world. And his point was not political at all, but he said that, think of the panic that it's going to create. He tied it back to 9/11 and how we shut down air traffic in the United States. He said that if this hits, we'll shut down healthcare, and we'll shut down commerce, and we'll create the tent cities that were created in the 1918 Spanish flu. And he was concerned, and he asked us all to do what we could do to heighten the awareness, as there aren't the financial resources being devoted to the research and preparedness of this tremendous pandemic that is facing us. So I really applaud you for bringing this, and would exalt you to get it out.
Yeah.
He said, whatever we can do, this is the number one threat. He said, nothing in his last 30 years of being in research scares him as much as this one does.
Larry, thanks very much for that call. Dr. Monto, what about that? Is that the scale we should be worried about this on?
I think we should be very worried and doing what we can in terms of both research and logistic preparation for what we hope will not happen. The thing we have to be a little concerned about is being careful in how we communicate the level of risk that we have. It could be very bad. But as with anything that might be in the offing, it might not happen. Yeah. Now, what is different about influenza is that from, let's say, a bioterrorist threat is that we know that we're going to have influenza every year. We're going to have seasonal influenza. And therefore, what we have to work towards is doing the things in terms of research and logistic preparation for a pandemic, which will also help us in controlling regular seasonal influenza. The work that Dr. Trainer was describing with vaccines will undoubtedly help us also in understanding how to prepare better flu vaccines. We have a good flu vaccine. We don't have a great flu vaccine because we still see nursing home outbreaks, even in well-vaccinated nursing homes.
Dr. Monto, we have to take a short break here. We'll continue our discussion about avian flu after this short break. Thanks very much, and stay with us. This hour, we're talking about flu, and my guests are John Traynor, Associate Professor of Medicine and Microbiology and Immunology at the University of Rochester School of Medicine and Dentistry, and Arnold Monto, a professor of epidemiology at the School of Public Health at the University of Michigan. And just before the break, Dr. Monto was talking about the need for better vaccines, so let me turn to Dr. Traynor and say, what are the prospects for better vaccines? Are they in our future, or are they still a ways off?
Well, I think there are a couple things that are on the horizon as far as vaccines for the regular sort of flu that we have during every year. I think we'll be looking at some vaccines maybe that don't rely on eggs for their production. That's kind of a technical advance that might help to make the vaccines more available or ready earlier in the year. And I think people are interested in adding things to the vaccines that will make them more effective. These are materials called adjuvants that stimulate the immune system to make an even better response. And there's quite a bit of interest in trying to add those sorts of things to the flu vaccines to make them work better, especially in older people whom, as Arnold has pointed out, oftentimes are not as well protected by flu shots as we wish that they were.
Would there be any advantage in having a better flu vaccine for the sort of standard human flu in combating an outbreak of avian flu, or would they just be working at cross purposes?
Oh, no. Actually, that's a very important part of being prepared, because when you think about it, if we were to deploy a vaccine to prevent a new pandemic, it would be used in potentially billions of people. So it would be much, much better to go forward using a vaccine that uses the same technology that we use to prevent regular flu, so that you'd have confidence that the new vaccine would be safe and effective. You're really going out on a limb if your approach to a pandemic is to use something that's completely experimental. So anything we can do to improve conventional flu vaccines will clearly help us in the long run.
Let's take one more call now from Joel in San Francisco, California. Joel, welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you very much for taking my call. Back in the mid-80s, I worked for a biotech firm that was genetically engineering vaccines for the use in the poultry industry. A lot of the vaccines that we manufactured were based around the H1N5 virus. We were actually splicing in multiple genetic material into these. A lot of them were licensed and are used in the poultry industry today. Is there any chance that there's some coincidence that these things are allowing for multivalent jumps between different types of animal flu? I'll take your comments off the air.
Okay, Joel, thanks for that. And Dr. Monto, maybe you can explain what Joel meant by multivalent jumps, if you want to tackle that question.
Well, I think the concern might be that live vaccines were being used. I'm not sure if the vaccines that have been used in poultry are actually live vaccines. It's a good point, though, in terms of use of vaccines in poultry. In Hong Kong, part of the strategy for controlling and preventing a return of this virus, which did cause outbreaks in 1997, has been use of a vaccine, which is a killed vaccine, in poultry. And they believe they have been able to stamp out avian transmission of this virus and therefore protect indirectly the humans by use of the vaccine. Now, you may ask why this isn't used more extensively, and the problem is that this vaccine doesn't produce what we call sterilizing immunity. What that means is the bird doesn't get sick, but it may still get infected at a low level. Now, this isn't a problem if you are living in Hong Kong, but if you are in Vietnam, or more particularly Thailand, and you're you've got a financial commitment in terms of vaccination of the poultry, but even more important for a country like Thailand, which exports chickens for food to Western Europe, there are restrictions on exporting vaccinated birds. So, as usual, everything comes down to logistics and economics.
It's a complicated problem, both technically and socially, and now, as you say, economically. But we're going to have to leave the discussion at this point because we've run out of time for this segment. I'd like to thank my guests, Dr. Arnold Monto, a professor of epidemiology at the School of Public Health of the University of Michigan, and Dr. John Trainer, associate professor of medicine and of microbiology and immunology at the University of Rochester School of Medicine and Dentistry. Thanks to both of you.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.